It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin's alcohol regulations are notoriously arcane. As part of our ongoing High Tolerance series, we'll try to understand these laws and how they became so difficult to comprehend. Alcohol manufacturers, distributors, retailers, we want to hear from you this morning. How have recent changes to Wisconsin's alcohol regulations affected you and your business? Do you own a brewery, winery, or distillery? What are your thoughts on the three-tier system? Or maybe you're an alcohol distributor. How have the laws had an impact on you? Do you agree with the way Wisconsin regulates alcohol, or do you think there need to be changes? Let us know at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, good morning.
Morning, John.
Wisconsin's three-tier system for regulating the alcohol industry is, as we said, notoriously complicated. Sean, as you've reported on this, what struck you the most about how Wisconsin regulates the alcohol industry?
I was struck on a few occasions by just how complicated it felt. And I'm trying to think about when I started reporting on this and was getting to know kind of the basics of it. You know, one thing that really got me was just the way that the state even identifies its different type of alcohol licenses. So, you know, as you and I are conversing about this here, it's almost hard to talk about it, but there's a Class B license, and then there's a Class B license, and they mean different things depending on where quotation marks appear. So if it's a Class, quote, B, close quote, license, that's for selling beer on premises. If it's a, quote, Class B, closed quote, license, that's something else. That's a liquor license. So that, you know, that to me sort of blew my mind. That's
wow.
Widely accepted, and that's just the way that our alcohol laws are written. But it's well known in the industry that that's the way it goes. And so, you know, when lawmakers see, you know, a budget motion get added to the budget late at night, or even a bill that has a public hearing, you look at these things and they're written in those terms. And so it takes a little homework to kind of know even what they're saying. And then once you know what they're saying, you can start to digest it and make more sense of it.
Well, it seems like applying the adjective arcane is perhaps maybe even understating it a little bit. Can you give us a sense of how this is supposed to work in Wisconsin, at least in theory?
In theory, it all sprung out of prohibition. So, and that's not to say that our laws as they are written now are of the prohibition era, but the system generally grew out of prohibition because from 1920 and through 1933, alcohol was illegal in the United States. And when public sentiment began to shift against prohibition, and it was getting obvious that states were going to have their own alcohol regulations, there was some thought about what that should be like. And so kind of the guiding principle for a lot of these state alcohol laws, because the 21st Amendment left it up to states to regulate this stuff, is this report that was commissioned by John D. Rockefeller. He was a teetotaler. He supported prohibition, but he wanted to make sure that once states got out of prohibition, that there was going to be a regulated alcohol industry, that there was going to be some order to it. And so states kind of looked to this report toward liquor control for guidance. And one of the kind of the guiding principles of this report is that they didn't want to have too much influence from one, you know, they didn't actually use the term tiers, but one part of the industry over the other. So they didn't want to have, for example, what was known as a tied house, where one retailer, let's say a tavern, was under contract from a big brewer to sell exclusively their beer. So that had, before prohibition, you had big breweries that would, you know, sign all these contracts with these bars to get them to sell only their beer. And the thought was that, you know, these breweries were, they weren't even in there. They had no stake in the community. They didn't care if the bars were orderly places. They were kind of chaotic, led to corruption, violence, et cetera. And so this document said, let's try to prevent that. And so that is, that's sort of where the foundation for these laws came from. But the idea of this three-tier system that we talk about today kind of developed years after that.
Well, there are a lot of exceptions to these laws. Let's talk about some of them and why they exist.
So so I'll talk about like the system in theory is three tiers, which are manufacturers, breweries, wineries, distilleries, the people who make the alcohol, wholesalers or distributors. Those terms are used interchangeably, really. Those are the people that deliver the alcohol. And then retailers. So that could be a grocery store, a liquor store, a tavern. It's where you buy the alcohol. So in theory, manufacturers make it, distributors deliver it, and then the retailers sell it directly to consumers. Where there are exceptions to those rules, some of them are historic. You know, like we didn't have a clean three-tier system exactly coming out of Prohibition. So, you know, brewers had retail licenses way back when. Some of them are kind of, I guess, practical. We created a brew, or pragmatic, let's say. We created a brew pub license in Wisconsin in 2007. This was created because there were businesses like the Great Dane in Madison who wanted brew pubs. And so they wanted to have like six restaurant locations potentially where they brewed their beer. So they created a special license for them. You know, so there's those pragmatic concerns over the years, and there are a lot of very specific exceptions to the alcohol laws to let, you know, even a specific restaurant get a liquor license they couldn't get it before, just kind of by the way that they're carved out in the statutes. You know, that's where you see these exceptions. But then you also see in the laws, you see prohibitions, we'll say. Maybe the wrong word since we're talking about prohibition, but we'll see restrictions on what people can do. And sometimes those are also put in there by industries, you know. I think a lot of the restrictions that are put into the laws were backed by, you know, the distributor lobby in many cases to kind of protect the distributor industry.
Who benefits from this system? Who are the winners and losers in this?
It's I would say I would have a hard time looking at it and saying that the laws specifically as they've been changed have not been beneficial for distributors. And that's, I'm not going to say that created a group of losers in the process exactly, because, you know, you just look at Wisconsin in the past decade and the number of breweries has just skyrocketed. Wineries, the same thing, not quite to the extent that breweries have in pure numbers, but wineries are growing all over the place.
And distilleries now, we're seeing a lot of those pop up. Craft distilling is becoming an industry as well. Sean, stay with us. We will continue our discussion of Wisconsin's arcane alcohol laws with Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief. It's all part of our series, High Tolerance, about Wisconsin's often complex relationship with alcohol. If you are in the industry, what do you think of the way Wisconsin's alcohol laws have been written and applied? How has this affected your business? 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. We're trying to make some sense out of Wisconsin's arcane alcohol laws. WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is with us. Alcohol manufacturers, distributors, retailers, if you're involved in the industry, what do you think of how Wisconsin regulates alcohol? You own a brewery, a winery, or a distillery. We want your thoughts on the three-tier system. Do you agree with the way Wisconsin regulates alcohol, or do you think we need to make some changes? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sean, has there been an unintended side effect of this three-tier system of disagreements or competition between manufacturers, distributors, and retailers?
I guess one side effect has been just that it is a bit confusing for somebody who wants to get into this industry. Just you look at the difference between places that brew beer and sell food. You know, if I want to be a brewer and have a brewery license, I could sell food at two retail locations, but that's it. If I want to be a brew pub, I can sell it at six retail locations, but I can only brew up to 300, or excuse me, I can only brew up to 10,000 gallon barrels of beer per year. If I'm a brew pub, I can't own a brewery. If I'm a brewery, I can't own a brew pub. So there's sort of the one side effect, I guess, is all the confusion. Mm.
And then there's some other weirdness, too. For example, a craft distillery in Wisconsin, I can't order that from Superior. I can't order it shipped to Superior. But if I'm out in Arizona, I can order it.
This is foundational, you know, knowledge within the industry and in the way that part of the system works. If, you know, I talked to a distiller for this story. People can go to his tap room. He knows every ingredient of what he makes, you know, knows what the farmer where he buys the grain, makes the mash, distills it. You can buy the spirits that he bottles at his tap room. But if the bar around the corner who legally buys them runs out of his booze on Saturday night and asks him for a bottle, he can't give it to him. It's got to go through a distributor first, or he could be fined and even jailed. Literally, the statutes say up to 9 months. You know, whether that would actually happen, I don't know. But these are the kind of penalties that exist. And they do vary, as you mentioned, from state to state, because each state's laws and the exceptions and protections that they decide to put in there are up to them.
So there have been some changes in recent years. What are some of the most significant changes we've seen?
Yeah, so what really struck me when we were talking about laws that have their foundation back in 1933 is that in just the past 20 years, there have been some really big changes when it comes to the distributor tier or the wholesaler tier. So, you know, just run through a few of them. In 1999, former Governor Tommy Thompson signed a budget that gave liquor distributors special protections under what's known as Wisconsin's Fair Dealership Law. And practically speaking, this made it harder for larger distilled spirits manufacturers to fire a liquor distributor. So once they've got that contract there with a liquor distributor, they have to show cause to end the contract or else they can't get out of it. In 2003, this is something that was specific for breweries. Governor Jim Doyle signed a law that made it harder for breweries of any size to fire a beer distributor. And what it did is that it said that if you are a beer distributor, you have a contract. Excuse me. If you're a brewer and you have a contract with a distributor, you have to find another distributor to buy out of that contract at fair market value. Hmm. So what does that practically mean? Let's say that I'm a brewer in Dane County and I'm doing $100,000 worth of business, just as a simple number here. If I'm with distributor A, I'm not happy with distributor A. I want distributor B to buy me. Distributor B might have to pay $300,000 to distributor A just to get the rights to sell my beer. And I, as the brewer, don't get a dime of that.
What public purpose is being served here?
So, you know, I can only speak to that law specifically, I understand. Distributors say what you don't realize, what the public doesn't realize, is that we put a lot of money into selling these beers. So if you see a beer truck rolling down, delivering beer in, you know, Madison, for example, if it's wrapped in a Miller Lite logo or it's wrapped in a New Glarus logo, That truck is not owned by Miller Lite. It's not owned by New Glarus. Those are basically just rolling billboards that are owned by the beer distributor. In those cases, that's Frank Beer Distributors in Madison. So they're saying we have to have that brand compensation law to protect the investment that we've made in the brand. But, I mean, it's different. It's a different kind of protection, obviously, than you see in other industries.
Why have distributors been such a powerful lobby for so long? Why does it make sense to favor distributors over manufacturers and retailers?
Well, I mean, they are very active at the Capitol. They have, I think, they're widely regarded as having, a strong lobbying presence there. They also are very active in political campaigns. Wisconsin Democracy Campaign review of donations from distributors going back 20 years, so they'd given $3.3 million. And just to put that into some context, the Democracy Campaign tracks different interest groups by how much they give, and that put distributors in the top 5% of those special interest categories. So, you know, that's pretty high.
Yeah. Craft brewers, though, have been gaining political clout that they didn't have in the past, and we're seeing craft brewers, are we seeing them take up some of the political space that distributors used to?
Well, I would say, you know, distributors have not been alone. They've had, often in their corner, they've had the Tavern League of Wisconsin. And so the Tavern League also gives money, but not as much as distributors. They have this kind of grassroots power. They have 5,000 members throughout Wisconsin. That's almost half of all the liquor licenses in Wisconsin. And they're pretty vocal. What you've seen in the past is that those two groups, when they teamed up, would kind of get what they want. But recently, craft brewers, number one, they've been growing. There's just more of them. And then they're in all these legislative districts throughout Wisconsin. They're popular there. Suddenly they have some political power. Not only that, but they've teamed up with Americans for Prosperity, namely, also other conservative groups who've kind of taken up their cause. I mean, these are groups that don't like regulation particularly, feel like these regulations are sticking it to the little guy, they say. And so you have this alliance of breweries, wineries, distilleries, and Americans for Prosperity, a big big group, a conservative group that gets its funding from the Koch brothers. And they have, it's not that they've been able to get stuff that they want passed in the legislature, but they have been able to get it blocked. So a couple of things that the distributors and the Tavern League wanted last session really didn't go anywhere. They were met with very vocal resistance by Americans for Prosperity and this new coalition of craft producers in Wisconsin.
So why are we sticking with the three-tier system when it's so confusing? Why aren't we changing the laws so they're easier to understand and follow?
This law, it has been described by many people as like 20 pages of law, 200 pages of exceptions. And so to start over from scratch would be, it's not that it's undoable, but you're creating a lot of battles there. Right now they're not able to change too much to the law because there's sort of a standoff between what, you know, we'll oversimplify, I'm calling the old guard and the new guard, right? And so they can't agree to simple changes to the law right now. It would be especially difficult to rewrite the whole thing, and there's been a lot of resistance from, members of the industry to do that, to open things up and start fresh.
Have lawmakers ever considered an alternative way of regulating the state's alcohol industry?
There's all sorts of ways to do it. I mean, I don't remember in my time here anybody sitting down and saying, let's make complete, let's start from scratch, let's do it new. There, in some states, the state, like state government, actually has a huge role in the system. Like they are the distributor tier. So government is an active player in the alcohol industry. We don't have that here. There's other models that people could follow, but really, anytime you talk about a change, it's almost always, it seems like, adversarial. If you help one member of the industry, if you help distributors, it can come at the expense of brewers or distillers. If you help a brewer, a tavern owner, a tavern league might think, hey, that's going against my interests. You know, whether or not that's always the case could be debated, but that's kind of the way they view these changes is when you do something for them, it's hurting me.
This system is so complicated, and we've done a lot of stories trying to explain it here at WPR. It's got to be a tough job just to try to make sense out of all this. Sean, thank you for you and all the other reporters who've been reporting on it and keeping us enlightened.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief. You can read more from WPR's High Tolerance series at WPR.org/alcohol. Coming up next, a recent study by UW-Madison students found that medical and decriminalized marijuana in Wisconsin could produce more than $1 billion economic benefit, in part from fewer traffic deaths and ER visits. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin is known far and wide for its beer culture. And in recent years, Wisconsin's political culture has been getting plenty of national attention. But as Brady Carlson reports for our series High Tolerance, beer culture has long been a part of Wisconsin politics.
Milwaukee was in the mood to celebrate the day Democratic Party Chair Tom Perez came to announce the city would host the 2020 Democratic National Convention. The celebration was very Wisconsin, a beer toast. Only as the glasses clinked together and cameras clicked, things got messy. They spilled beer on the paperwork. Not intentional, but for those in Wisconsin politics, also not surprising.
It's a shorthand and quick way to convey something by having a beer.
That's political scientist Mordecai Lee of UW-Milwaukee. He says for out-of-state politicians looking to show they're in touch with Wisconsin culture, a beer is a way to do it.
You know, it's not that different from, I don't know, campaigning in Chicago and having a Chicago hot dog or a deep dish pizza. For politicians, the sort of simplistic, stereotypical instant messaging that happens with a photo op with beer, they continue doing it.
National figures have done it a lot. Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and First Lady Betty Ford, just to name a few. The pictures of candidates raising glasses of Wisconsin beer are a timeline of American politics. Lee points to a visit from Ronald Reagan, who used his beer photo op to make a point to the state's conservative voters.
Sitting next to him is the police chief of Milwaukee, who was identified with conservative politics, even though he personally was a civil servant and couldn't do an endorsement. And here was a situation where Ronald Reagan was able to convey several things at the same time.
In-state politicians recognize the value of a campaign beer, too, though their take on the tradition is perhaps less cynical.
On the national level, having a beer with a politician is a cliche. In Wisconsin, having a beer with a politician is a way of life.
That's Brian Reisinger, who worked on campaigns for top state Republicans like U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and former Governor Scott Walker. He says on the campaign trail, you go where people are. Festival beer tents, breweries, bars, even tailgate parties outside Lambeau Field.
It's kind of hard to take part in the beer on a setting like that because you're warm and you've got hours of walking to do and it could go badly for you. But you get cheersed a lot. You get a lot of toasts.
And you can get a lot of attention, like when Ron Johnson's campaign released a video of the senator partaking in...
It was a chug.
Johnson downed a Miller Lite in seconds, apparently impressing the bartender.
That's pretty good.
And getting plenty of attention in news and social media, the kind of attention Reisinger says campaigns dream about.
It was one of those moments where it didn't really matter what your politics were. You just were like, hey, that's cool. That senator just slammed a beer like my buddy would on Friday night. And it was a way for people to relate to him. And it was the best thing about it was a real moment. We never could have scripted or come up with it. It just happened.
Bridging political divides with beer doesn't always work, judging by the protests outside the bipartisan Beer and Brat Summit Governor Scott Walker held after the 2012 recall campaign. And pouring a beer can backfire, as Hillary Clinton learned during a 2016 primary event. Tammy Plourd of Pearl Street Brewery in La Crosse was there.
You know, I kind of gave her the lowdown. You know, you got to pull the tap handle all the way forward. You can't half do it. But she just didn't pull the tap handle all the way forward, and that just created a lot of foam.
The campaign trail increasingly runs through craft breweries like Pearl Street. Candidates can pay tribute to Wisconsin's beer history and highlight small businesses at the same time. But craft beer is growing across the country. Will Wisconsin's blend of beer and politics still stand out? Tammy Plourd says yes, because to her, these moments aren't just about the beer.
Wisconsin's very good at being down home, very relatable, very friendly, and we just kind of want to experience all that together. And I think Wisconsin will always stand out for that.
And if that doesn't work and the beer and politics connection goes out of state, Mordecai Lee has an idea to keep candidates coming here.
I'm guessing the incoming product that's going to replace it is going to be cheese. After all, we're already called cheeseheads, and our motto is America's Dairyland.
If nothing else, you can't quite spill cheese on a contract the way you can with a beer. Brady Carlson, WPR News.
You can see a slideshow of politicians drinking in Wisconsin and read the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. A recent study by UW-Madison students found that medical and decriminalized marijuana in Wisconsin could produce more than a $1 billion economic benefit, in part from fewer traffic deaths. We talked with two of the study's authors about the research behind their estimates and some of the limitations they faced. As the morning show continues, questions for you, the listener. What questions do you have about allowing medical marijuana or decriminalized marijuana in Wisconsin? What do you want to know about marijuana in other states? Do you agree with the authors of a recent study that medical and decriminalized marijuana would be an economic benefit to Wisconsin? Why or why not? And what do you just think about this topic in general, about the idea of decriminalized marijuana in Wisconsin or medical? Would you buy it for medical reasons? How do you think the drug should be regulated? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ari Brown and Ben McBride are the two authors of a recent study looking at the economics of medical and decriminalized marijuana in Wisconsin. The study was completed by students at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. Ari, your study found that allowing medical marijuana in Wisconsin and decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana in the state could produce an economic benefit of more than $1 billion. Can you give us an overview of the main economic benefits that you found?
Sure. So we used a lot of different state data and experiences from other states who have gone through this process to kind of come up with what have those states seen. So the main benefits that we found, first of all, a demand for the actual product itself. We estimated a demand curve for those who would purchase medical marijuana. We also found, alleviated criminal justice enforcement costs if there were to be decriminalization, taking some time off of some time and effort off of those who are currently enforcing laws related to the criminalization of marijuana. And then you mentioned, traffic fatalities. We found that medical marijuana in states that have, in a couple of studies in states that have legalized medical marijuana, they've seen a bit of a substitution effect with alcohol, and the incidence of traffic related deaths related to alcohol versus related to marijuana. There are fewer deaths when drivers are under the influence of marijuana. So that's where a lot of that benefit comes from. And then we also looked at opioid addiction and fatal overdose risk in a lot of states that have legalized medical marijuana. There have been substitution effects with using opioids, especially to treat chronic and intractable pain. So studies that we used there were from Canada and Michigan. And then one specific study that we looked at really closely was in Minnesota, where they've been really tracking closely their medical marijuana users who are using for intractable pain. And a lot of the experiences that they've seen have been that their users are substituting marijuana for opioid usage. So those are really the big benefit areas. We also looked at administrative benefits in terms of fees and licenses that would come from users and from dispensaries in the state.
Intractable pain, can you give us a definition of what that is?
So I don't have a direct definition with me, but essentially pain that is long-lasting. One definition that we looked at that's in a lot of state bills is chronic pain, basically pain that is has a really big effect on a person's life and is, not something that they might overcome just living day by day through their life that they might need to take some sort of medication for.
Ari, you also estimated how many people in Wisconsin would consume medical marijuana. How did you make this estimate, and what number did you end up with?
So this was one of the more complicated things that we had to kind of go through. We found that a lot of states that currently have medical marijuana in place don't really do a great job of tracking or publishing data related to their registries. So we went through a lot of picking and choosing in terms of what states we would actually use to come up with that estimate. We ended up using five different states that we used a five-year time horizon in this study, just looking at the first 5 years of implementation. And what we found was there were five states that that have gone through at least 5 years, or sorry, that four states that had gone through at least 5 years, but five states that had good, reliable data in terms of what percentage of their population was on this registry. Florida was in the first year, but they had good data, so we used them for year one. And then New Jersey, Delaware, Arizona, and New Mexico. And we kind of used their percentages of their population in each of the first 5 years to estimate a percentage of the Wisconsin population, kind of coming up with a range from of those five states, the lowest state to the highest state. And making kind of a broad estimate based off of those percentages as to what percentage of the Wisconsin population would be on the registry. And we found, you know, year one, year two, it's under 1%, but by year five, it's actually over 2%. And this is consistent with what other states have seen.
And did you exclude medical marijuana users in Minnesota and Illinois while estimating Wisconsin's potential customers?
We did. The reason that we excluded Illinois was because their medical marijuana law does not include, just recently expanded to include serious diseases causing chronic pain and debilitating conditions. The Wisconsin law that we, the Wisconsin proposal that we modeled our study off of was a proposal in 2017, Assembly Bill 75, that had language in it regarding what conditions medical marijuana could be used for. And it wasn't really consistent with Illinois. So that's why we excluded Illinois. Minnesota we excluded because Minnesota does have medical marijuana in place and actually has great data, but Minnesota is one of the only states that has medical marijuana in place and does not legalize the selling of the flower of the plant. They only sell things like edibles and oils, which is not really consistent with most of the other states mm-hmm. that have medical marijuana in place. So we also thought that their data would be a little bit inconsistent.
Ben, quickly before we go to a break here, Ben McBride, has there been previous studies looking at the economic impact of marijuana in Wisconsin?
There have been smaller studies that look at the effects of legalizing medical marijuana, but not a large study like this. And that was really a challenge we faced with trying to get some of the data and determining the impacts. And we hope that there will be more in the future. Obviously, this is a topical area, but we hope to... We hope that we started the ball rolling here.
We'll have more with Ari Brown and Ben McBride on their study of the economic impacts of medical and decriminalized marijuana in Wisconsin. The study was completed by students at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. And that conversation continues in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Ari Brown and Ben McBride are two authors of a recent study looking at the economics of medical and decriminalized marijuana in Wisconsin. The study was completed by students at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. We're hearing about what they discovered in their research, and we invite your comments and questions about their findings at 800-642-1234. Kurt is on the phone with us from Milwaukee. Kurt, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you for taking my call. You know, I have a question about Colorado. You know, the biggest, one of the problems that the truck drivers are seeing out of Colorado is the fact that in the Department of Transportation doesn't allow people with CDL licenses to be intoxicated with marijuana. I mean, how do you see that? How do you see this legalization affecting, you know, nationwide truck traffic?
Kurt, thanks so much for sharing that. Ben, Ari, which one of you would like to tackle this one?
I can take this one. So I think this is a really good question. It kind of exposes the difficulty with doing research on marijuana, both medical marijuana, which our study looked at, and recreational marijuana, which Colorado has legalized. And that's that at the federal level, marijuana remains a tightly controlled substance that isn't approved for use in any medical or recreational capacity. And so federal regulations, including those produced by the Department of Transportation, continue to classify marijuana as a Schedule I substance. In the states that have decriminalized or legalized any type of marijuana, there's a different level of enforcement, and it contributes to this multiple-tier system. And so while I can't specifically answer what would happen to truck traffic nationwide, I can speak to the uncertainty that this dual system causes, in that a lot of states with medical marijuana or recreational marijuana laws, it becomes very difficult for businesses to navigate what is permissible, what's not permissible, what services can be used, what services can't be used. And this extends to a whole range of things, not just trucking, but also banking, everything from rent and tenant laws. All of these things have a huge effect, and they're all driven by this kind of dual policy at the state and federal level.
Ari, what do we know about the number of people who use marijuana currently in Wisconsin? Has the drug become more accessible with medical marijuana legalization in neighboring states?
So from what I've seen, Wisconsin stacks up like many other states, specifically states around it. But what we do know is that there does exist a major black market for marijuana. And I do think that, you see Michigan recently in November of 2018, legalizing recreational marijuana, Minnesota and Illinois having, medicinal marijuana in place, that's definitely there. You're going to see some effects from that. To what extent, I'm not sure yet. And because these laws are changed so rapidly and are so different from state to state, and as Ben mentioned, federal legal oversight is kind of in question always. I think it's definitely going to be something to watch going forwards, because we don't know and we can't estimate precisely how much consumption there is and how much black market activity is going on.
Ben, roughly half of the economic benefit that you found would come from fewer traffic deaths. So let's understand that a little better. First, how do you estimate the benefit of one less death? I mean, are we talking about lost wages over the span of a person's life or other costs?
So to answer that question, we use something called VSL, or Value Statistical Life, which incorporates kind of the social and economic benefits that an average person accrues over their entire life. So it includes any type of cost or benefit that you get from your life, which is kind of a difficult thing to wrap around, because you're monetizing a lot of the things that we think are non-monetizable, but it's the best estimate we have. And in our study, we looked at the literature and said, you know, the VSL number that we use, which is about $10 million, is roughly in line with estimates of a statistical life, and is something that's used widely by both federal and state agencies for calculating these types of benefits.
Because of the limited research, your study included a simulation that tested thousands of possible outcomes. Ben, can you tell us more about that process and what you learned from it?
Yeah, so we use something called a Monte Carlo simulation to perform a robustness check on our estimates. And a Monte Carlo simulation involves specifying a distribution for each of our estimates and then taking random draws from that distribution and plugging them into our equation to test what would happen under thousands of different scenarios. So in the fatal traffic accident example, for instance, we calculated what would happen under a range of different estimates for the increase or decrease in traffic accidents related to the legalization of medical marijuana. And that's why in the study we produce ranges of estimates, not just a single point estimate. We create a range of possible estimates so that any reader who's really looking at it can get a true scope of what the possible benefit or cost would be in each case.
So let's. What do we know about marijuana's effects on drivers? Does it impact concentration or reaction time in the same way that alcohol does, Ben?
So it's difficult to say if it's in the same way that alcohol does. That's a pretty difficult comparison to make. But studies examining the isolated effects of marijuana intoxication on driving performance do find either moderate increases in crash risk or statistically insignificant increases in crash risk. And what's important there is the moderate component. So it's not clear if marijuana really decreases your ability to drive or operate a motor vehicle, or if there's something else going on at the time. And these estimates become super fuzzy when you look at demographic characteristics. So whether the driver is male or female, whether they're old or young, whether they have a lot of experience or they're inexperienced. And so what we did is we looked at aggregate numbers at a statewide level, as opposed to taking an individual driver and simulating what their behavior would be.
Ari, you recommended the state review best practices while designing the program and evaluate its program after 2 years. What state would you consider a model for Wisconsin, either in its practices for establishing a program or for its monitoring?
I think it's really tough to say because, first of all, the law that this is based off of, Assembly Bill 75, is written in the same way as a lot of states that currently have medical marijuana laws on the books. What I would actually recommend is looking at different states for different types of experiences, because I think that there's a lot that different states can say about what has worked well for them and what has not. For example, I would look to Minnesota in terms of data collection. Minnesota does a fantastic job with their data collection. If you go to the Minnesota Department of Health website, they have incredible information available, really detailed demographic information on the users on their registry. But other states have laws that are more in line with what Wisconsin might actually put in place. So I think that naming one or two states for Wisconsin to look at kind of like ignores the fact that Wisconsin can really look to the experiences of a lot of different states for different components of this, because laws change so quickly and because they're written so differently, which is why we used the experiences of so many different states in making all of our estimates. In terms of, you know, creating our demand schedule, we used the experiences of Canada, New Mexico, and Illinois. For our population estimates, we used Florida, Delaware, New Mexico, Arizona. There's just so much out there that can be used as an example. And there's also so much out there to avoid because states have had negative experiences with it.
And Ben, finally, with you here very quickly, what else would you like researchers to explore here, do you think?
Well, I think a lot of these estimates remain uncertain, and that's kind of reflected in the ranges you can see, but also in the availability of data. So a big one that we don't even touch on in this report are the health effects of medical marijuana. And the National Academies recently came out with a compendium of effects, and they recommended that the federal government take a more active role in researching those medical effects. And I'd kind of echo that. I think that's the next area.
A lot of work left to do here. Ari Brown and Ben McBride, the two authors of a recent study looking at the economics of medical and decriminalized marijuana in Wisconsin. Thank you both for coming in this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson, and for Kate Archer Kent, you're listening to the Ideas Network.